We're about to hear the Dallas Symphony Orchestra and conductor Jaap van Zweden and the Dallas Symphony Chorus and a group of soloists as well perform this piece written by Stephen Stuckey and Gene Shear, August 4th, 1964. Composer Stephen Stuckey and librettist Gene Shear are joining me. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining me.
Nice to be here.
Nice to be here, yeah.
What was the occasion for the commission of this piece and the composition of this piece?
The Dallas Symphony noticed that the 100th anniversary of Johnson's birthday was coming up in 2008, and they wanted to commission a concert-length piece to somehow mark this occasion. And so our original assignment was simply to do something involving Johnson, and the field was wide open. Gene started reading all the Johnson books and went down to the Johnson Library and discovered a historical coincidence that made it possible to make a really rich combination of events, I think.
Gene, what was that coincidence that you discovered?
For about two or three weeks, I was just at the library in Austin, and I was looking through all sorts of things, reading letters and all sorts of primary source material. And I stumbled upon this really coincidence that on August 4th, 1964, two major events in Johnson's presidency collided, and the two iconic issues of his presidency collided, and that was the Vietnam War with the incident in the Gulf of Tonkin, and also the discovery of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman's bodies, these three civil rights workers who were murdered by the Ku Klux Klan. And on that day, LBJ was dealing with these two major issues, and I thought this was a good way of sort of depicting what the core issues of his presidency, and watching him deal with it would help to, you know, illuminate who he was and his strengths and his weaknesses and that moment in our nation's history.
There are a lot of different ways you could get at unpacking the events of that day and the meaning and the consequences and the resonance of the events of that day. How did you decide to go about it?
Well, there are primary source options, which I took advantage of, but I didn't want it to be a documentary. This is still a work of art, and I think Stephen and I were both trying to depict the feeling of these events and the feeling for Johnson and the feeling for the country, and that's what music does so beautifully. So I was drawing on a diverse group of sources, but some of the things that I included were a postcard that Andrew Goodman sent to his mom before he was murdered, and a story that the Cheney family told me about what had happened in their family's past. And it was weaving this with other things, that We Shall Overcome speech, and also a lot of newspaper articles. You see, what happened was that Fannie Lee Cheney and Caroline Goodman were activists throughout their lives. Caroline started the Andrew Goodman Foundation, which still today is doing wonderful work. And so because of that, there was lots of threads that I could sort of discover, lines and that she and Fannie Lee had stated that were in newspaper articles. So I was culling from lots of different sources, material, and sort of weaving it together. And then, of course, giving it to Stephen, who could really wonderfully depict with music what was happening. And I say what was happening, what all of this felt like. And I think that's really, in the end, that's what we were trying to accomplish.
Librettist Gene Shear is joining me, and composer Stephen Stuckey. Their piece is August 4th, 1964, a day in the life of Lyndon Baines Johnson, president at the time, of course. The Dallas Symphony Orchestra, Jaap van Zweden, here at Carnegie Hall. We're about to hear the piece. Gene, what do we know about President Johnson's experience of that day? All these issues were coming up. What do we know about the order he saw these in and what he actually experienced on that day?
Well, you know, luckily, if you're president of the United States, there's usually a detailed record of what you've done. And there is, in fact, his calendar, which fills in what he was doing hour by hour during that day. However, in addition to that, I mentioned some of the sources. Another major source were the phone conversations. Of course, you know, LBJ taped his phone calls. And so the phone calls that he made during that day, which you can really tell what he was thinking about, but also what he was feeling, because you can get the intonation, the tone. He was talking about the poverty bill at one point, because, you know, it was, in quotes, a normal day that was superseded by these other events. So what we can learn a lot from the cadence of his voice, the content of what he was saying, And all of it, because he was president and because he had the made the decision to tape all of his conversations, there is a pretty robust record of what was going on that day. Of course, you know, after Nixon, I think they probably had new ideas about what to do about taping conversations. But at that time, every conversation was recorded, at least all the conversations that took place from the Oval Office.
And remind us, in a nutshell, what was the Gulf of Tonkin episode as we thought at first and then as we discovered later?
Well, there had been an exchange of fire in the Gulf of Tonkin 2 days earlier on August 2nd that I think actually did happen. And then there were conflicting reports on August 4th of another attack by a Vietnamese vessel on an American vessel. There was a lot of confusion. You have to remember that communications were not what they are now. So you'd get cables relayed from Hawaii to California to Washington and then translated or mistranslated. And so it seemed as if there were another attack in progress. And if it had been the second attack in 2 days, it would have been alarming. In fact, it didn't happen, as McNamara later admitted. But in, I think, all that genuine confusion, the president and the Department of Defense felt that the country was under attack.
You see, when the first attack took place, it could have been a rogue commander who ordered that attack. The idea was that if it happened twice in 2 days or in 4 days or whatever, then it was clearly the intention of the Vietnamese. But, of course, that wasn't the case, as Stephen just said.
And as we first understood that event, as we first thought we understood that event, what did that mean and what did that become for America's involvement?
Well, it allowed the president to get Congress to pass a resolution enabling him to go to war, and it prompted Johnson and McNamara to begin that very night, actually, just before midnight, the bombing campaign over North Vietnam.
And on that night, LBJ went on television and announced that the bombing had begun.
You mentioned McNamara and his role in this. There's a moment in the piece called McNamara's Lament. Gene, let's start with you. What are the words in that moment?
Well, the words come from McNamara. You see, McNamara, of course, later in his life, reconsidered what the decisions that he had made and realized that they had made false choices or choices based on erroneous information. And his books is called An Argument Without End, and that history is an argument without end. And so that line is included in it. But he also details the consequences of the choice that they made. He doesn't know what might have happened had they realized on August 4th that the attack had not taken place. Of course, there's no way of knowing how history would have unfolded. But the bomb started dropping that day, and this huge rallying of the American response happened that day. So it's hard to know what would have happened, and I think it's his lament about how events played out after that day and the choices that he and Johnson made.
And Steve Stuckey, how do you approach setting that in music?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that movement was added at the very last minute. We had 11 movements, and I was almost finished with the composing, and Gene called up one day and said, you know, we have to add another movement. And I don't know if you could tell over the phone, Gene, that I sort of fell on the floor in despair, because I thought, you know, the horse could see the barn at that point, and I thought I was going to survive. But in fact, it really makes the character of McNamara finally something more than a cardboard figure, you know, taking him out of the action and making it reflective. That's probably the emotional high point of the piece, when McNamara says 58,000 U.S. dead, 3.7 million Vietnamese dead, you know, it sinks in. And that's, in fact, the thing that ties these two stories together, the civil rights story and the Vietnam story, as Gene says in the libretto, so many sons would not be coming back from both campaigns.
The piece is called August 4th, 1964, and it's about events from that day and their resonance and their consequences. I can't help but think of another president who was also from Texas using what turned out later to be, we discovered, incorrect information or incorrect interpretation of information to justify military involvement. Were those other connections present in your minds as you were creating this piece?
I think those connections were present in my mind, but I wasn't focusing on them when I was doing my part of the work. You know, I think if you just try to illuminate what you're working on and be honest about it, and you are able to depict sort of the way in which things actually happened, the way people actually acted, then other people will find other moments that are parallel. I mean, I think if you read a great play about whether it's Henry V or something like that, the play is about Henry V, but of course it can extend to other circumstances. So was I aware of the parallel? Absolutely. But was I trying to be didactic and make a point? Because when we were writing this piece, that was happening in the Gulf. And was I trying to make a point about that? No, I wasn't trying to be didactic. I think in the end, even though this is about politics, it's really about something that's even larger, which is the way in which people interact with each other, the psychology of people, which writ large becomes what happens politically, I think. So what I was working on was just the piece that was right in front of me and Steve.
That's why we're lucky to be making art instead of documentaries or political history, because those human emotions, those human interactions can be made universal and can be, you know, used by every listener in the way that he or she needs.
And both of these stories that are incorporated into August 4th, 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin story and the civil rights story, the murders of James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, Michael Schwerner, these were huge national stories that had consequences and resonance for everyone in our country from then until now. But, Gene, you were saying that you dealt with the families of at least James Cheney and Andrew Goodman, and for them it was not just a national story but a very personal story.
Absolutely. And I should say that I did contact the families after the piece was in large measure formed, but I had lunch with Ben, James's brother, and I showed him what I was working on and sort of got his okay on it. And then Steve and I interviewed David Goodman and discussed the piece with him. I'm really glad they're going to get to hear it tonight. They weren't able to come to Dallas, Texas, so I'm delighted we can share the piece with them this evening. But yes, this was a very personal story, and you know, Ben told me some amazing stories. You know, I asked him, I said, "How did you actually find out what happened on August 4th?" He said, "Well," he said, "they got a phone call, but what had happened throughout the summer was the authorities, police, FBI, would show up on their doorstep with clothing." It's an amazing story. With clothing that they had discovered from people that they had dredged from the river. And they said, "Did this belong to your brother, or did this belong to your son?" And so what was happening is while they were looking for these three civil rights workers for the bodies, or looking for the whereabouts of these three civil rights workers, they discovered tens, you know, 20, 30, 40 other people who had been disposed of, but who, as you know, Steve's great line, that their hometown newspaper wasn't the New York Times, so it wasn't getting the publicity. So it was very personal. It remains very personal. I think that that's what the Andrew Goodman Foundation is about and the work that they're doing today, whether it's 9/11 or whether it's the civil rights workers who were murdered at that time. We don't want to forget.
You know, I think Gene and I were afraid that only people of our generation would remember these events well enough to understand the piece. And one thing I'm very glad about is it's turned out that young people, even if they haven't internalized these events, get it right away in a performance. And so we're helping, I think, to keep these very important stories alive.
You know, the family members have had more than 40 years now to come to terms with the fact that a murder of a member of their family has tremendous public meaning. But I wonder if even still there were any reservations about turning this into a symphonic piece, into a work of art like this.
I was skeptical for my own personal reasons. Of course, I wasn't directly involved, but I was a teenager in the 1960s in Texas. Johnson was my local president, and that wasn't an easy relationship to be in, you know, especially as an adolescent. And I was rather reluctant to go back there. Gene, I think, took me back there in a beautiful way by showing me how this was not about history but about basic human emotions and relationships. And I'm very glad that I went back on that journey, and I hope that others of our generation have that reaction too. We noticed in Dallas that the audiences at the premiere were rapt by not so much by how good our work was, but by how powerful the material is. And I think people found it difficult to speak about these events after the piece for a little while, and then they couldn't stop talking. It opened some floodgates, you know, for people who lived through these events of the 60s. And it opened these events to younger people who hadn't had a chance yet to think about them.
And composer Stephen Stuckey, you met with some of the associates of Lyndon Johnson. What effect did that have on your approach to the piece?
I'm not sure that it actually illuminated the piece directly, but it was just a very inspiring moment. I met with Judge Harry Barefoot Sanders.
Barefoot Sanders, there you go.
And that's his real name, yeah. Who was a White House official and Justice Department official. And then he became a federal judge in Dallas and, in fact, among other things, desegregated the Dallas schools. And also with Harry Middleton, who was the press secretary, I think, for Johnson, and ended up as the director of the Johnson Library in Austin. And to see these old lions of the 60s, you know, survivors of that generation of Southern liberals, still proud of their associations and still talking about Lyndon as if he were in the next room, you know, making little jokes about him and wondering whether he'd pulled the wool over Doris Goodwin's eyes when he was giving her those interviews, you know, and so on, just gave a very inspiring personal connection back to those days.
And we talked a little bit about the resonance from 1964 to times closer to us, but I wonder if, especially at the premiere in Dallas, if there was any resonance the other way, because Lyndon Johnson would not have become president except for events in Dallas a couple of years earlier, the assassination of President Kennedy.
Well, somehow that has to be in the back of your mind when you're in Dallas, and it's right downtown, you know, it's very close, actually, from the side of the assassination, Dealey Plaza. One of the first things the Dallas Symphony had me do when I was making my trips down there was to go to the sixth floor, you know, the Texas School Book Depository, where there's now a beautifully run museum. And that was a very profound experience. I don't know that it influenced the making of the piece directly, but it's hard not to think about that when you're in Dallas. As far as the Dallas audience goes, I think the audience were self-selected. There weren't people who came to protest this idea, of course. So we don't really know what's in the minds of people who avoided the piece because it was too painful for them.
There are four vocal soloists, soprano, mezzo-soprano, tenor, and baritone. Do they have individual roles or characters that they stick to, or are they trading off roles?
No, they play actual characters. Although it's an oratorio-style piece, they essentially stand and sing, but, you know, in a dramatic way. The soprano soloist is Mrs. Cheney, the mother of James Cheney, and the mezzo soloist is Mrs. Goodman, the mother of Andrew. The tenor is Robert McNamara, and the baritone is President Johnson. And then the chorus doesn't have a very specific role, but they play a kind of Greek chorus occasionally, commenting on the action. And in the battle scenes, when the military cables are coming in and McNamara and Johnson and their team are trying to interpret what's going on in Southeast Asia, they sort of narrate, you know, the action.
As you worked with the Dallas Symphony and the chorus and the soloists and the conductor, Jaap van Zweden, on this piece, I wonder if any of them had personal reflections for you or personal reminiscences or experiences that came to mind that they brought to this experience.
There aren't particular stories, but there are particular feelings that I recall. I mean, I just remember after in the green room and elsewhere, people reflecting on remembering it, but not telling me, at least, you know, specific anecdotes or such. But I do know that I think it's fair to say that the chorus was very much into the piece, and they did a beautiful job, and I'm sure they'll do a beautiful job here at Carnegie. It was a very, very moving performance, and I think that in general that the buzz was really, really quite wonderful after the performance, and folks were really reflective and moved by what they had heard, and for those who had participated, what they had just performed.
We're about to hear this piece, and I wonder if the two of you could help set up what happens right at the beginning of the piece, both in words and in music. And maybe, Gene, we could start with the words.
The piece begins with both mothers saying, "It was the saddest moment of my life." and describing August 4th, 1964, what had happened when their sons' bodies were discovered. And they reflect on that, and it soon becomes woven with a chorus in which Caroline Goodman remembers that at that time she, in order to comfort her, she placed a poem by Stephen Spender on the wall of her apartment in New York City. And that then when we segue into a scene in the Oval Office in which McNamara is describing these early accounts that he had just received of what he believed was going on in Vietnam. And so we set up these two stories colliding right from the get-go of the piece, and then we go in different directions thereafter. But my intention was to stake out immediately what this piece was about. And so with comments discovered from newspaper articles and from telephone conversations and from other sources, I weave together these two stories, and then Stephen beautifully takes it to a whole other realm with music.
And composer Stephen Stuckey, what's happening with music at the beginning of this piece?
Well, that first number, I think, is the key to the whole piece, as Gene says. I remember when he showed me the mock-up of the libretto for the first number, and my doubts about whether this was a good idea vanished, because I could see how powerfully dramatic are these juxtapositions between the grieving mothers, between the busy sort of men at work planning a war, and then this sort of spiritual moment when Caroline Goodman's favorite poem is sung by the chorus. So there are three styles of music. There's a kind of tragic, lamenting music for the mothers. There's a kind of busy, testosterone-laden music for the Oval Office activities. And then this quiet, choral, a cappella mostly, hushed, spiritual reading of the Stephen Spender poem. And those three kinds of music then recur quite often for the next hour.
The piece is called August 4th, 1964. Music by Stephen Stuckey, libretto by Gene Shear. We're about to hear it performed by the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, led by Jaap van Zweden. Gene Shear, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much.
And composer Stephen Stuckey, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Fred.